Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 402 for December 15th, 2012. Coming up in a few minutes.
I went to bed the night before we actually got the spirits still fired up. And I really mean this. I mean, if I was a religious man, which I'm semi-religious, I would say, dear God, please, will you make this work? You know? And I did.
The last time we caught up with the legendary John McDougall, he was helping teach whiskey schools at Blaadnock, bottling his own casks and working with the Wild Scotsman, Jeffrey Topping. That was a few years ago, and John's branched out since then into consulting on new distilleries. His latest project was the Dingle Distillery in Ireland, and that sleepless night was 2 weeks ago. We'll catch up with John McDougall later on WhiskeyCast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Whiskey Cast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Ever since Beam Global became a standalone spirits company a year ago, there's been the expectation that sooner or later, Diageo would eventually launch a takeover bid, either on its own or with a partner. The potential partners have been the source of a lot of speculation, but we got word this week of an unexpected entry in the sweepstakes. Bloomberg News reported this week that a Suntory executive acknowledges that there have been quiet discussions with Diageo on what could be up to a $10 billion joint takeover bid for Beam. There's also a report that Suntory is considering an IPO for its food and soft drinks business that could help raise capital for acquisitions. However, no offer has been made directly to Beam, and Bloomberg's report indicates Suntory won't make a bid right now because Beam shares are too expensive. Beam ended the week at $61 a share. Meanwhile, The Telegraph reports Diageo would only be willing to offer $65 a share for Beam. That's not considered to be enough of a premium for Beam directors to consider the deal. Diageo is also moving forward with its acquisition of United Spirits, which includes White & Mackay. And CNBC's Indian Channel reports that both companies are prepared to sell a stake in the Scotch whiskey unit, if that's what it takes to get regulatory approval. The stake could be as high as 35-40%, and the CNBC report suggests UK private equity firms are interested. Just a bit of speculation and analysis now. If Suntory and Diageo were actually to try and split up Beam, how would the whiskey business be affected? Analysts expect Diageo to cherry-pick most of Beam's bourbon brands, since that's the one weak spot in Diageo's whiskey portfolio. Suntory will begin distributing Beam's whiskeys in Japan next year as part of a switch involving Asahi and Brown-Forman, which had been Suntory's longtime partner, so Suntory might well take some of the bourbon brands as well. And since Diageo already faces antitrust issues over White & Mackay, Suntory could take the Beam assets in Scotland, Laphroaig, Ardmore, and the Teacher's Blend, and incorporate them into its Morrison Bowmore unit. That would give Suntory control of both Laphroaig and Bowmore distilleries on Isla, but it would probably receive little objection from competition authorities. Again, this is just a bit of analysis. No formal offers have been made to Beam, and if one does come, it's not likely to happen until well into the new year, if then. You also have to remember that Beam has maintained all along that it intends to remain independent. Who knows? Beam could try to make an offer for White & Mackay to beef up its own Scotch whiskey portfolio. Moving on now, there's a breakup of Springbank Distillers underway. Nothing hostile, though, and certainly nothing to get upset over. J&A Mitchell is spinning off its Glengyle Distillery and the Kilcarran Single Malt into a separate company. It'll be known as Mitchell's Glengyle Limited starting on January 7th. Jenny Carlson will return to the Mitchell's fold to become sales manager for Kilcarran, leaving Ronald Watson responsible for Springbank, Longrow, and Hazelburn.
The main idea is really to bring extra focus and attention onto Glengyle and Kilkerran, to bring the whisky out there to people who maybe haven't seen or heard or tried it yet, so that long term we can begin to build on the initial successes we've had with the first few releases of Kilkerran, but also so that we can start to increase production at the distillery over time and really start to step out of the shadow of Springbank and emphasise that Glengyle is a distillery in its own right.
Now, what's going to happen between now and 2016 when you get to the 12th birthday and you have the 12-year-old Scotch available? What happens between now and 2016 as far as Glengyle is concerned?
Yeah, well, we're going to continue with the work in progress series. We are going to be having a look at the volume of whiskey we release under that range. To date, it's been limited to 9,000 bottles per release. We may well increase that slightly as we build up to 2016. Again, just in order to kind of get the ball rolling and really start to bring the attention onto Kilkerran. And in terms of the distillery itself, you know, we're going to be really working on the tours that are available at the distillery, really, really encouraging everyone who comes to Springbank to take a little bit extra time to come and see Glengyle as well, so they can appreciate the differences between the two distilleries, and also to emphasise the fact that there is another, hopefully fairly prominent working distillery in Campbelltown.
A lot of whisky companies try to look for economies of scale by combining operations whenever they can, but this appears to be an exact opposite by splitting off Glengyle and Kilkerran from the main Springbank distillery with, I would presume, a separate sales staff, separate marketing, separate production staffs, almost a deleveraging of Kilkerran and Glengyle in this case. That's somewhat an unusual approach to take, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Many people will know that Springbank have never really been afraid of bucking the trend or treading our own path when it comes to these kind of things. We are very, very keen to really emphasise that, you know, Kilkerran isn't just Springbank's little brother. It's not just another brand from Springbank, but it is a whisky in its own right. And we feel that under our present sort of arrangements, that there is a danger that Springbank would continue to overshadow Kilkerran and it would never really get the attention that it deserves. So we feel that separating it off, giving it its own sales and marketing team, will help us to expand on that.
How about the distribution ends? Will that change in terms of any contracts for distribution, or will the distributors all stay the same around the world?
We've no plans to make any changes at the moment. When Jenny Carlson comes on board, she'll take over full responsibility for those kind of things. But certainly as things stand at the moment, we don't have any plans to make any major changes.
Now, is there any change in production staff at Kilkerran and Glengyle?
No, it will continue for the foreseeable future to be run by the staff from Springbank, really just taking 4 to 6 weeks out of their Springbank schedule to go and run Glengyle for that period of time.
Can we see that changing over time, possibly, to run Glengyle more full-time?
I think that is very much our long-term aim. I think if things go to plan, you'll certainly see production expanding as much as we physically can at Glengyle. It won't happen overnight. It could take a few years, but the plan is certainly to have two sort of 52 weeks of the year operational distilleries side by side.
Now, how does this affect Springbank? Does it let you guys focus on what's going on at Springbank with the flagship distillery?
It does indeed. We've always had in our production schedule and sales forecasts Kilkerran growing year and year and year. And the danger that presented for the Springbank brands would be that the focus could slightly be left off of Hazelburn and Longrow, which are both very, very important brands to us, but it would only be natural that as Kilkerran becomes bigger and Springbank continues to grow, that Longrow and Hazelburn could have been slightly forgotten about, both by ourselves and everyone around the world. So we want to make sure we can continue to push those brands as much as they deserve. So moving Kilcare into the new company will certainly allow us to continue to push those out there.
And correct me if I'm wrong on this, Longrow and Hazelburn are actually distilled at Springbank, right?
That's right, yeah. So it keeps them, it keeps the Springbank family, if you like, and then the Glengyle product separate, yeah.
So while I've got you on the line, what are we going to see as far as anything new coming out of Springbank and also on the Kilcarran side between now and in the next few months?
Well, the kind of main things from Springbank point of view anyway, over the next couple of months, we've got the latest batch of 21-year-old Springbank is going to be bottled at the beginning of January when we return from the holidays. Following that, we're going to be doing a Longrow, Rundlets and Kilderkins, the Longrow that's all been matured in small 60 and 80 litre barrels, which is quite an interesting whiskey. We did a Springbank of the same name last year and of the same production style, and it was a very, very big success. So this year, early next year, we're going to be doing the Longrow version of that. And then sort of the focus on new releases certainly will probably move to Kilcarran by the kind of springtime. And while we don't have any definite plans for how we're going to approach the release of Work in Progress 5 from Kilcarran, it's fair to say it will probably be slightly different to the previous releases when Jenny gets her teeth into it and has the chance to decide what exactly she wants to do.
Of course, the fourth release of Kilcarran Work in Progress was honored in the Daily Drams category of the Malt Maniacs Awards earlier this month. You can hear more about the awards on last week's episode. In other distillery news, there's a game of musical chairs going on among some of the distillery managers in Scotland. It all started when Shane Fraser stepped down as production manager at Glenfarclas to become the first manager of the new Wolfburn Distillery, now under construction in Thurso. Glenfarclas has now hired Callum Fraser away from Deanston Distillery to replace Shane Fraser. Callum has been at Deanston since it reopened in 1990. He became the manager there 6 years ago. No word yet on his replacement at Deanston, but if your last name is Fraser, it might just help. Jack Teeling stepped down from Ireland's Cooley Distillery after it was sold to Beam at the end of last year, and he's been plotting his return to the whiskey business for the last few months. His Teeling Whiskey Company has now released a new poteen bottling. If you're not familiar with poteen, it's the Irish equivalent of new make or white dog spirit right off the still. It may be more of the Irish equivalent of moonshine, though, since it was illegally produced for centuries after being banned in Ireland. Poteen is legal now, and with the demand for non-aged whiskies by bartenders, Teeling decided to make it his second release. The first whiskey from Teeling is called the Hybrid. That one's a vatting of Cooley single malt and 10-year-old Brickladdie single malt from Islay. It's taken a couple of years of arguing, but the English Whiskey Company will finally be exporting its whiskies to the U.S. Like most single malt producers, the Nelstrup family has been aging its whiskey in ex-bourbon or ex-sherry casks. But since the distillery is not located in Scotland, U.S. regulations banned the Nelstrups from calling their whiskey single malt without using new charred oak barrels. Well, they've produced a batch of single malt that now meets the U.S. standards, and the whiskey will be launched in March. Special thanks to Bernard Vianen for passing along a link to EDP24's story on this. And his comment, strange to discover that there are different rules for Irish and Scottish companies and others for the rest of the world. Well, it's not just the Scots and the Irish. Canada also falls under U.S. laws that recognize the standards those three countries set for whiskey, while requiring everyone else, including Americans, to play by a different set of standards. The regulations haven't been updated in about 30 years at least, and back then those three countries were the only other ones producing whiskey for export to the U.S. for the most part, so they were allowed to set their own standards. Unfortunately, the Treasury Department's regulatory agenda does not include a rewrite for whiskey standards to bring it in line with today's reality. And finally, with the Glenfiddich 125th anniversary celebrations winding down, the last of 11 bottles of 55-year-old Janet Sheed Roberts Reserve Single Malt available to the public was auctioned off this week. Glenfiddich's Mitch Béchard was at the auction in Los Angeles.
We had it up in Beverly Hills in Los Angeles at a private residence, and we tied it in with the WRI, which is the World Resource Institute. So very much a think tank for environmental issues around the world. And yeah, it went fantastically well. We had 140 people there, and the bottle went for $60,000.
Which is a pretty good price, but not as high as some of the other ones went for in the series, right?
Yeah, correct. The previous one in New York for us went for $94,000. So this was a little bit less, but we're still very, very happy with the outcome, obviously. And, you know, it's going towards a fantastic cause, as all the other bottles have around the world.
Do you know offhand how much has been raised with these 11 bottles around the world?
It's close to $500,000 we've raised with all 11 bottles around the world.
And the remaining four bottles are staying with the family, right?
Correct. That's correct. So four bottles were made just for the family.
By the way, at least one of the 11 bottles is available for sale. World Duty Free was the winning bidder at one of the auctions and has placed its bottle up for sale in the World of Whiskey's Duty Free shop at Edinburgh Airport. The price, £50,000, or about $81,000 at current exchange rates. And that's the week's news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Visit us on the web at glenmorangie.com or download our iPad app at the iTunes App Store. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well made.
Let's check the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Had a great email with a question from David Ongst that I wanted to share with you, because the same question came up here this week. Here's what he had to say. Hi, Mark. I love your podcasts. I've been listening now for the last 8 months and have gone back and downloaded all of the past episodes I could get my hands on. I can't thank you enough for all you've taught me about whiskey since I started drinking it at the beginning of this year, so many, many thanks. Now to my question. I've started to acquire some nice bottles in my collection, and I'd like to share some of them with my friends. However, they can't always come over to my place, and that made me think that I could just give them a small sample or tasting from some of my better bottles by pouring a sample into a small empty 50-milliliter bottle like the kind you find on airplanes and in minibars. The problem is that I've found it very hard to find small, decent, clean 50ml bottles, or even drams. Do you have any suggestions on where I can obtain these types of bottles? I've found some empty chemistry set type bottles as well as some nail polish bottles for sale, but the reviews all talk about their lack of cleanliness. I'm worried about the possible residue that I might not be able to clean out of such containers and that might affect the taste of the samples. Furthermore, are there certain types of plastics that I should avoid using because they'll alter the taste of the whiskey? I should also mention that I don't plan on shipping these bottles, merely handing them off to my buddies for enjoyment. Many thanks in advance for any suggestions you have on how to solve this challenge. Well, David, thank you for the kind words and for your question. It's really timely because my wife and I were discussing the same thing this week. You see, I take a bunch of small bottles when I go to whiskey festivals so that I can bring back samples to do tasting notes on them. Well, Christina found a great source for those bottles this week, and I'll be placing an order for some after the holidays. SpecialtyBottle.com, that's all one word, SpecialtyBottle.com, carries glass vials in different sizes that hold up to 4 drams of whiskey, with prices of between 40 and 75 cents each when you're ordering less than a caseload. And if you have a few friends, you could probably cut that cost even more by ordering a full case. David, thanks again for the question. And if you have a question or a suggestion, I'd love to hear from you. You can always post it on our Facebook page or just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
My name's Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Whiskey Cast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Barry Crockett, Master Distiller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
The pot still category is receiving so much attention nowadays. I think what we will see as time progresses is that the single pot still category will indeed resume its rightful place at the very top end of the whiskies of the world. And of course, this is only correct given that Irish whiskey has had world recognition for not just decades, but you could say for centuries. And Redbreast is at the forefront of that.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know, no Redbreast.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Lafroig. And if you're in the Houston area, Reserve 101 on Caroline Street downtown will be hosting Lafroig's Simon Brooking for a free tasting this Tuesday evening on the 18th. Meanwhile, Villa Contour in Limburg, Germany has whiskey tastings on December 26th and the 28th. The Scotch Whiskey Experience in Edinburgh will hold its annual Hogmanay Distillers Fair December 29th and 30th. The Astor Center in New York City will kick off 2013 with a class on the origins of flavor in Scotch whiskey January 4th. This week's Slate.com article on whiskeys will not be on the reading list. The Whiskey Weekend Amsterdam is January 11th through the 13th, and the monthly second Saturday single malt tasting at the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming is on January 12th. Finally, the Victoria Whiskey Festival will be January 17th through the 20th in Victoria, British Columbia. Of course, I'll be there that weekend. I hope to see you there. And those are just some of the events coming up over the next few weeks. There's a full calendar at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Lafroig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Lafroig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Lafroig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. In 1886, William Grant set out to fulfill a lifelong ambition, to make the best dram in the valley. Today, a rarity in Scotland, Glenfiddich still remains independently owned by the fifth generation of the same pioneering family. This unique legacy of skill, passion and pride forges a long-term commitment to creating truly great single malt without compromise. Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To learn more about our award-winning range and join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
It's time for this week's WhiskeyCast In-Depth, and I'd like to welcome a new sponsor to WhiskeyCast this week. Woodford Reserve is signed on to bring you the In-Depth segment each week, and I hope you'll join me in thanking them for their support of WhiskeyCast. Now, John McDougall may well be the only person to have managed distilleries in all five of Scotland's whiskey-producing regions during his career. He's semi-retired now, but still bottling his own casks and working with Wild Scotsman founder Geoffrey Topping and helping new distilleries get off the ground. His latest project is Ireland's Dingle Distillery, which produced its first spirit just 2 weeks ago. Now, back in 2007, I interviewed Ian Henderson, like John, a former manager at Lafroig and other distilleries in Scotland. At the time, Ian had been working with the Nelstrup family to get the English Whiskey Company off the ground, and he took some grief over helping Englishmen make whiskey. So, I started off by asking John whether he'd had any reaction to helping an Irish distillery get started.
There's room for everybody in this world, and there are not that many, I don't think, people who perhaps have got the experience now that I've got. And as a result of that, I look at myself as being more a whiskey man in general. Although Scotch is obviously my particular background, but whiskey in general interests me greatly, and at this stage of my career, I don't see why not.
How did you wind up working with the folks at Dingle? Did they reach out to you? Did you reach out to them?
I was recommended to them in 2008, actually. I've been working with them off and on since 2008, and I was recommended to them by a third party who recommended me to them, and then they contacted me.
So tell me about the distillery, because I think, is this the first one you've actually designed?
No, I was very much involved with the box distillery. I designed the box one as well in Sweden. And that one started in 2006, and we got that up and running in just 2 years ago, in 2010, just round about now, 2 years ago. And I was also involved in the early parts of the design for Kilholman and Dathmill. I've been involved in four distilleries that have actually come to fruition, and I advised Sean Dunne on one or two aspects of his Glenarmore distillery in Brittany way back in 2006 or 7, I think it was.
And he's making very good spirit out of
it. He's making great spirit, Mark. So I've also been involved in a few projects that unfortunately started but never got to the finishing line. These things happen, you know. Either the runner...
Oh, they certainly do.
Yeah, you know. But I enjoy that side of it. I really, really do enjoy that side of it. And it's... apart from doing talks and tastings and doing our own bottlings, which we're still doing, of course, and doing stuff with the Welsh Scotsman and stuff in Germany and all over the place, I do enjoy the aspect of designing and helping people to develop the distillery projects and seeing it through to fruition. And the Dingle one was very exciting. So was the Box one, actually.
So tell me about Dingle.
Yeah, what do you want to know?
The location, what makes this special? What encouraged you to work on this project?
Well, I was encouraged because I liked the people for a start. I liked the fact that they are very much entrepreneurial, and that's a very overhyped and used word sometimes. But if the general flow is going to the right, the boys at Dingle go to the left. And they also, of course, have developed craft brewing in Ireland. They've got the Porterhouse Brewery Company in Ireland. And Oliver Hughes, the head honcho there, very interesting character, very charismatic gentleman, started, and he was a barrister, and he gave up being a barrister to brew beer. And I liked that sort of thing. The guy was he's a bit of a maverick, very much a one-off, but he's got good team around him in his Porterhouse company, and they make tremendously good beer. To the extent that they're exporting, I see their beer when I come to the USA, I see their beer in Sweden, I see their beer all over the place. And they've got pubs and restaurants and all sorts of things in London, New York, and Ireland, and stuff like that. So Oliver has been going to Dingle, he's got a house there, and he's been going to Dingle for 25, 30 years, and he's always had this dream about he'd like to put a distillery, and the first purpose-built distillery for nearly 200 years at that in Ireland. He wanted to put it in Dingle, and that's what he's done.
And this is Oliver, right?
This is Oliver Hughes, yeah. This was his dream to do this. And he's a young guy. Well, I'll say a young guy. Young for me, Mark. But I would say Oliver's in his early 50s.
And so what inspired you when you're designing the distillery and designing the stills? What did you draw on from your experience?
Well, he asked me to, in 2008, I went across for the first meeting with these guys, with him and his production team at the brewery, and he's got some really good guys there. He's got a very good beer brewer, so that side of it was not a problem. The mashing and the fermentation was no problem. He already had a brewer in place at the brewery, you know what I mean? So that, mm-hmm. that was no problem. And then he had several other people who were his marketing and salespeople and the PR people and stuff like that. So they decided that they wanted a particular style of whiskey that could be distilled in Ireland. And so we came up with something which, after blending several whiskies together, we came up with a whiskey that a composite, if you like, or a new product, basically, that he said, "Now, John, I want you to design stills that will produce that." I said, "Oh, thank you."
That's the hard part, isn't it?
That's the hard part. I mean, the coming up with the recipe to design the actual whiskey and the style of it from several other things we did, you know, sort of at lab level. I mean, that's interesting and it's great fun. And once you've got it, that's fine. But then you've got to distill it. And it's going to be new spirit before it ever becomes whiskey. And then you think to yourself, "God, am I going to manage to do this?" You know what I mean? But we came up with it. Of course, triple distilled. And I was very pleased about that because we could have stuck two stills in, but Irish traditionally is triple distilled. This is not pot still. This is malt whiskey he's making at the moment. I mean, but he could produce Irish pot still if he wanted to, but he's majoring on malt whiskey right now, and he wanted a delicate, soft, creamy, malty, sweet sort of whiskey. Not peaty at all. He didn't want heavily peat. So he wanted a so smooth and so velvety. So I got got my thinking cap on and came up with all sorts of ideas and things and talked it through with the still makers. And eventually we came up with a design which was unique to Dingle.
Now, this is kind of unusual in that you're starting with a finished whiskey and working your way back to figuring out how to make it, right?
Well,
that's sort of the backwards. That's sort of the opposite of what most distillers do, right?
That's right. Well, this is the nature of the beast, though, Mark, and I'm not meaning to sound twee or anything like that, but we had to have some idea of what he was looking to do and what he was looking to produce after maturation. We had to have some idea of that. And so, therefore, when we had the idea of that, then that gave me the ammunition and the information that I needed, that I thought I needed anyway, was to design the stills to produce the new spirit that would hopefully turn into the type of whiskey he'd be looking for after several years in wood. And the new spirit, I've got to say, I mean, I was just absolutely, well, I would say this anyway, I suppose, but I went to bed the night before we actually got the spirit still fired up. And I really mean this. I mean, if I was a religious man, which I'm semi-religious, I would say, dear God, please, will you make this work? You know? And I did. Because, I mean, you know, it would have been a real bummer, if you like, if what had come out the next day wasn't very good as new spirit. But it came out as so smooth. It came out, I mean, it really was. And everybody agreed, not just me, because we had several people nosing it and tasting it that day. And independent of me. So I was quite delighted when they came up with a consensus saying, wow, I mean, you know, this is for a new spirit. I mean, this is fantastic. So I was really...
So tell me about those stills you designed. How did you, what did you come up with in the final design to produce this?
Well, and we have one wash still and an intermediate still and a spirit still. And the wash still is a lovely, don't forget, these are not huge, massive stills, but they're bigger than micro, if you know what I mean. But they're not massive stills like you have in huge complexes. But the wash still is a lovely, flat, what I call flat onion, where you've got a lot of surface area for the heating process to take place, which actually sort of does away to some extent with the problem or the potential problem of the wash boiling over the top of the swan neck. So we don't have a huge problem with boiling up over the swan neck. And therefore, in fact, we have no problem at all with that. And then we designed it that way, particularly in the layout of the coils and the stills, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that was all deliberate. Everything we did was deliberate in order to produce beautiful, beautiful vapor leaving the still and no nasties coming across the top. It was all deliberate, obviously. And so that was the wash still. The intermediate still was interesting because I put a huge boil ball in the intermediate still in relation to the rest of the still. I put a massive boil ball in which joins the shoulders of the still to the head of the still. And the reason for that is dead simple. I told everybody and everybody who visited the distillery that was to, in order to purify and get the maximum reflux we could in secondary and tertiary distillations taking place at the intermediate point, so that what was leaving that still conceivably could have been whiskey itself if it had been a double distillation. It was that good. And then we went for the third distillation, which just polished it off. And we put a smaller boil ball in there and got some more secondary and tertiary distillations. And what we got coming out was just like liquid velvet at the end of the day. I mean, it was just, but that was deliberate. It was all deliberate. I mean, it wasn't by accident.
So we know it's going to take at least 3 years, but given that Dingle is way down on the southwestern coast in County Kerry, and it gets a lot of the Atlantic trade winds and all that, and the Gulf Stream, so it's a little warmer down there, how long do you think it's going to take to get to a full maturity?
Well, I mean, clearly, I mean, 3 years is the minimum you can do before you can call it a whiskey in Europe at all, as you know that. But I would have thought that by 3 years, there'd be something that would be very, very acceptable. I mean, I would say that with a high degree of confidence. But clearly, if you roll the stock over to 5 years, 8 years, all the rest of it, I mean, you're going to get differences as you do during maturation. But I mean, I would say it's going to be highly drinkable at 3 years, Mark.
So what else are you working on these days?
Oh, loads of things. but I've signed several non-disclosure agreements, so I can't tell you at the moment. But I'm doing other things as well.
What's going on with your bottlings?
Well, they're busy. We're very busy. We've had a very busy year with our bottlings, actually. And we're exporting to Germany, Austria, Japan, Sweden, Denmark, France, Taiwan, we're exporting a lot. We don't do much in the UK because, I mean, for that type of bottlings that we're doing, Mark, I mean, The market here is not good for that, and they're single cask, single malts at cask strength, so they're more acceptable to the aficionados in the other parts of the world than they are in the UK. But we're exporting to about 10 countries now.
Not to the US anymore?
Yes, we still do stuff with the Wild Scots. Well, I'm coming to the US in January, actually. I'm doing stuff with Jeff Topping in January, and I'm looking forward to that. And we'll do a bit of promotion of his stuff over there as well, because, I mean, we bottle it here for him anyway.
Well, as John mentioned, he and the Wild Scotsman have a busy tour schedule in the Midwestern U.S. at the end of January, starting off in Pittsburgh on January 21st, with stops that week in Columbus, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Rockford, Illinois. You'll find all of the dates and links on the calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. And that's this week's WhiskeyCast In-Depth, brought to you by Woodford Reserve. The craft of making spirits bright begins with Woodford Reserve. Visit WoodfordReserve.com for well-crafted holiday cocktail ideas. Craft carefully. Drink responsibly. Bourbon whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume. Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you by Bal Blair. I'm still in competition judging mode, so it's been hard to keep up with my regular whiskey tastings. However, I mentioned Lenny Eckstein of Deerhammer Distilling in Colorado a couple of weeks ago, and he sent along a sample of his new Downtime Single Malt Whiskey. I needed some downtime this week, so that seemed like just the right whiskey for the right time. It's bottled at 44% ABV. My sample came from batch number 1 and bottle number 3. The nose for Downtime has notes of caramel apples, toasted oak, honey, and hints of dried orange peel. The taste starts off tart and dry at first, with a cinnamon wave that rolls in and fades to reveal hints of orange pekoe tea with honey that linger through the finish. There's no age statement on this one, but I'm assuming it's a fairly young whiskey, and I'm not going to hold its youth against it. I'm scoring Downtime from Deerhammer Distilling an 83. Now, there's absolutely no way on God's green earth that Downtime could compete with a 31-year-old Ardbeg single cask, so we're not even going to try to compare the two. I brought back a sample of Ardbeg 1973, cask number 1146, that I got from the folks at Ardbeg's table during Whiskey Live Paris a while back. It was really cold the other night, so it was time for something peaty. This ex-bourbon hogshead was filled back in March of 1973 and bottled in October of 2004 at 49.5% ABV, with just 219 bottles available. The nose, peat and honey with heather and a hint of coconut, very smooth. The taste, in a word, great. Rich and smooth with peat traces and honey at first, before a heavy blast of peat and cinnamon that fades to reveal dried orange peel and just a slight brininess. The finish, lingering peat and very smooth with hints of orange peel, honey, and black tea. I'm scoring the Ardbeg single cask number 1146, a 94. You'll find my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android, and at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find WhiskeyCast HD videos and the WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings Monthly podcast, links for our Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, my photo gallery and print shop, the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com for your last-minute holiday shopping, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast is supported by Glenfiddich, the world's most awarded single malt. To join other single malt appreciators for exclusive news, vintage releases, and preferred events, visit glenfiddich.com.
Glenfiddich, skillfully crafted. Please enjoy responsibly.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2012, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, hoping the Mayans are wrong about December 21st, and we'll all be together again next week. If they're right, grab the best ram you've got. But if they're wrong, make sure you drink it responsibly. Thanks for listening.